Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Tulsa theater season is underway, and today we hear about one of the first productions of the year. Playhouse Tulsa continues its run of the Paul Rudnick comedy, I Hate Hamlet, tonight through Saturday at the Williams Theater, the Tulsa PAC. Rudnick is known as one of the funniest writers around, adept at plays, screenplays, novels, criticism, and comic essays. I Hate Hamlet had its genesis when the playwright moved into a Greenwich Village apartment that had once been actor John Barrymore's home. I Hate Hamlet follows TV star Andrew Rowley. Notice I said TV star, not actor. Rowley had a successful TV series, a few commercials, but now the series is over, and Rowley has moved to New York to hone his limited acting chops. He rents Barrymore's old pad, but as soon as he arrives, he finds he's been cast in a Shakespeare in the Park production of Hamlet, cast not as Laertes, or a lesser role, but as the Prince of Danes himself. And Rowley is floundering. But John Barrymore's ghost appears to coach Rowley to riotous effect. It's a very funny comedy, I Hate Hamlet, by Paul Rudnick. Performances continue tonight through Saturday at the Williams Theater. I'm joined by Playhouse Tulsa's artistic director and director for the production, Courtney Sanders. Courtney Sanders, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I Hate Hamlet. This is a funny play. Mm-hmm. It has the sensibility of the sitcom, very rapid-fire jokes, and it's sort of a conventional little play because the whole thing of the ghost that one person can see that nobody else can see.
So right.
It's a very traditional play, but it is a very funny play. Why did you choose this to open your season?
It's a really funny play. We had already selected everything else that we were putting into the season. And one of the key components of Playhouse is that we like to do something that's going to appeal to a wide audience base. We had a family Christmas show that we're doing. We have our drama with Streetcar in February. We have another Pulitzer Prize winning contemporary drama. And then we have a family musical that we're closing the season with. And so we needed something that was lighter, that was a comedy, and something that we felt was going to really launch the season in a big way. There were a couple of plays that we were choosing between, and I Hate Hamlet was the one that really stuck out to most of us.
So you do table readings, or how does a theater company choose what's going to go?
I have an artistic council, which is comprised of myself and my costume designer and my scenic designer and our playwright in residence. And so the four of us really shuffle around a lot of titles and plays and come to a consensus on what we think would be the best lineup. We have a list that is always moving around to see what we're going to put into the next season. And there are a lot of shows that we want to do that don't fit within a particular season. And so we have to, you know, put it on deck for later. But this one with I Hate Hamlet, it was pretty clear that it was one that we were all really excited about.
And it's a fun play. You know, you're quoting Shakespeare. You've got this the ghost of John Barrymore,
yes,
who's basically instructing Andrew Rowley, who is this mm-hmm. TV star. And I think that's really the best description for him.
Yeah.
He's not an actor. He's a TV star.
Yeah, and more in the...
And, of course, the script has a lot of fun with that.
Yes, it does. And, you know, now when we think TV star, he's the kind of TV star that would be geared to more reality television, not even, like, you know, great drama television, but
well,
more
you know, a lot of television
TV.
Stars today have had that long background, but you know, maybe right. in the 50s and 60s, it was like, hey, you've got a pretty face. Let's make you a TV
exactly.
star.
Exactly.
You know,
and that's kind of the equivalent. That's really what happened to him. He even mentions it in the play. He said, I'm a pretty face. That's why he got picked. He dropped out of drama school so that he could go be on a really bad TV show. And he did it for the money. So, you know, at least he's honest about it, I guess.
So, but now the TV show has ended.
Right.
And he's left Hollywood for mm-hmm. a little while. He's come to New York, and he's thinking, well, you know, I'll take some classes. I'll maybe actually start honing my chops.
Right.
But his agent gets him Hamlet right off the bat.
Exactly. He auditions, and she, Lillian, who's played by Barbara Mern, she pressures him into auditioning so that he can be taken more seriously as an actor. And he was, you know, his television show was really successful. It got canceled, but before it got canceled, it was successful. And so he was the name. And so the Public Theater casts him as Hamlet, and they don't realize how terrible he is at it when he gets the role. So he didn't think he would actually get the part, and he does. And there is a whirlwind of events that encircle around that that are really, really funny.
It really kicks off really quickly. This is a comedy that just sort of revs up from the very beginning.
Yes.
Gives you the very, basically the description you gave us within the first 5-10 minutes, and all of a sudden the real estate agent is having a seance around a card table,
yes,
bringing her mother to bring in John Barrymore to
exactly
help him because he has rented John Barrymore's old apartment. And they're talking about how that would be, you know, Barrymore would, he was the greatest Hamlet of all time.
Yes.
And all of a sudden something happens. And after everybody leaves, the ghost of Barrymore shows up.
He does. And he says that it's a tradition for all of the preceding Hamlets to help the next person that's playing Hamlet. And so he says, you know, it started with Burbage and then it went to Keane and all the way down the line until now he is supposed to mentor Andrew Rowley in the role of Hamlet. And that's why he is there. And it's very clear that he's not excited about being there because he thinks of himself as the quintessential Hamlet. So actually seeing Tyler Humphreys, who's playing John Barrymore, transform from this very conceited individual at the beginning of the play to actually caring about Andrew towards the end of the play is really nice for us as the audience.
We had to have two special actors for this because they're on stage probably all the time.
Yes, yes. Like 97% of the time they are on stage. And there are two people. Will Acker is a senior at ORU right now, and he is a wonderful physical comedian. So we get lots of the pratfalls and kind of this nerdy boy next door feel, you know, with him, who is, he's also this movie star, but he's painfully obviously not confident in his ability to be a movie star. And then Tyler Humphreys, who has worked with Playhouse for actually since we started with our first production of Romeo and Juliet. He's been with us and he's very polished and very regal and grand in his portrayal of John Barrymore. So it's a really nice balance between the two guys.
And of course, you have to have somebody who's almost larger than life if you're going to do,
yes,
Barrymore, because Barrymore is, you know, he's before amplification. He's playing to the rafters.
Exactly.
And in every yet gesture. And I assume the same is true in this particular piece.
Yes. Tyler and I talked about how important it was that he is very conscious of what his physical body is doing. And, you know, we're used to playing in contemporary theater very
natural.
Yeah, exactly. And so Tyler, I said, it's going to feel forced. You know, you're going to feel like you're being really forced and really big. And I said, I'm not going to let it be not honest, but we got to go for the big. And he did. And it's
sort of a take on Master Thespian, if you will.
It really is. It really is. And so we used a lot of different acting techniques to get him where we wanted him to be. And he's just great. And he has a lot of heart. You know, it's not all just about the shtick and the performance quality of it. You know, everything is grounded in a really honest place. So you get to see how these people journey through these series of events and how it affects them.
Just reading through the script, it, mm-hmm, reads like a sitcom.
Yes.
In many senses. And it's really almost like a theatrical version of a three-camera sitcom.
Right.
In many regards. What are the important qualities in making the comedy come off in that?
Well, there are several moments, you know, when you're doing a comedy, there are moments where you as the actor can feel where the laugh is going to go. And then there are moments when the playwright has dictated where he wants the laugh to go. And so it's really finding that balance. You know, there were a couple of times, actually, we did a preview performance last week on Thursday, and there were a couple of moments where you could tell that we thought that the moment was really going to get a laugh. And then there were other moments where it got a laugh and we didn't anticipate that. And so it really is based off of the audience. There are, you know, most of the time, the consistency and the laughs are coming at the same time. So the actors get used to where that's going to be. But sometimes an audience will surprise us and laugh where we don't expect it, which is great because then we just feed off of that. Then there are some entrances and exits with some of these characters that really play like a sitcom. You know, you should hear
like
the
applause. Kramer running through the door.
Absolutely,
right?
Yes. Uh-huh. And, you know, they'll enter and exit and you can just hear the applause track in your head. And so it's a really high energy show. Everything happens very quickly. But it's all of the need and the stakes and everything surrounding it is just really fantastic to watch.
Now, in a television sitcom, that energy is usually apparent, but it's always starts and stops.
Right.
And in a theatrical production, it doesn't stop. So
no.
So what is the key to getting that right amount of energy?
Really in the actors looking and seeing what they need, I'm a really big advocate on making it honest and connecting the actor's heart to the role. And what is important, and you know, what is the character looking for? How fast do they need to get it? How high are their stakes? And I think for the actor, when we approached it, they had to look at that. What was it that they were really fighting for, and what could they not live without? And when they found that, then it just catapulted them into the show, and they don't get it until the end of the play. And so for the whole 90 minutes, they are just on this, you know, steam train locomotive all the way to the end. And it's really great. It's exhausting. You know, we'll finish the run and Tyler and Will are just sweating. They're so tired, but it's really wonderful. You know, because with a comedy, if the energy drops, we lose the audience just for that split second. And with a show like this, it's got to keep rolling.
Tell us a little about William Acker, who's mm-hmm. doing this Andrew Raleigh character, who, again, yes. is his TV star. Young actor. Yeah. So he has that sort of in common with this character.
He does.
But can you talk about the process of him creating his character?
Sure. I talked to Will back in the spring about playing the role, and he was really excited about it and very nervous. But I knew I'd worked with Will before at some things that we had done at ORU, and I knew how physically specific he was in his comedy and how comfortable he was with his physicality on stage. And when I read the show, to me, that was Andrew. It's this very Dick Van Dyke sort of physical comedian. And I thought of Will. And so when we talked about it, he was really nervous, but he has such a great heart and this naive sort of boy next door, stars in your eyes quality that I knew for Andrew was going to be great because, you know, Andrew has this big movie star cover that he does. But then when it's just him and Barrymore in the room or him and his girlfriend, who's played by Tabitha Littlefield, we get to see this sort of panicked, anxious, oh, my goodness, I'm going to play Hamlet role.
I think perhaps one of the most telling things that Rudnick does is when you meet his girlfriend or mm-hmm. his fiance at mm-hmm. this point, they've never had sex.
Exactly.
You know, she's a 29-year-old virgin, and she's saving herself for marriage.
Right.
And here is this television star
right.
with a girl who, you know, they've never had sex.
Exactly.
And Barrymore is aghast.
Exactly. You know, and there's this conversation that Andrew and Barrymore have about, you know, Andrew asks him, he says, do you know what it's like to not have sex? And Barrymore says, no, because he doesn't. And so they're approaching it very differently, you know, but Barrymore has this appreciation for her desire to wait, which is really kind of endearing. So it's a lot of fun.
Well, I really enjoyed the reading of Barrymore because Barrymore seems like it's just a wonderful sort of scene-chewing role. I mean,
yes.
You probably have to tone it down, if anything, because the script is just so geared towards that.
It really
actor.
Is. Oh, my goodness. And he actually does, you know, he does throw his hands up in the air all the time. You know, his first appearance is in a thunderstorm. And so you'll see this flash of lightning and you'll see him appear. And then it happens again and he's not there. You know, and then when we really get to see him encounter the world of the play, there's smoke and lights and all of this sort of grandness that he has about him. And, you know, all of the sound in the show, there are music cues that happen sporadically and he controls all of it. So you'll see him, you know, conjure this music and then cut it off. And yeah, he's really larger than life.
Now, the minor characters, it's kind of interesting because just reading through a couple of the minor characters, mm-hmm. they're only there for a few minutes at a time.
Right.
But it's almost like the quintessential Hollywood character actor role where you really have to establish this personality, persona, really, just in a moment.
Absolutely.
Whether it's the theatrical agent or whether it's the real estate agent who's there at the beginning of the play mm-hmm. or the movie agent that comes in later or the producer, a friend that comes into this. They're really these sort of cliched
yes,
caricatures,
absolutely.
Really, but the lines are funny.
Yes, and that was one of the things that we talked about with the actors is that they're written very stereotypically, these characters are. The real estate agent who's played by Jenny Guy, and she's fantastic. She's very flamboyant and larger, kind of like Barrymore, larger than life, you know, wants to sell this penthouse at no, you know, the stakes are huge for her. She just wants to get rid of it because it's been on the market for so long. And so it's very stereotypical with her energy and her relationships with everybody else. But with all of that, we had to find where this person really lives, like what makes her honest and human. Because with a comedy, it's really easy to just play the shtick. And, you know, the audience doesn't get really invested. You know, we laugh a lot, but it's not, we don't really care about them. And for me, it was really important to balance the two.
My guest today is Courtney Sanders, who is directing the latest production for Playhouse Tulsa. She's also the artistic director. I Hate Hamlet by Paul Rudnick, which performances continue tonight through Saturday at the Williams Theater. Very sharp, Hollywood sitcom-like play, which is just very funny, conjuring the ghost of John Barrymore,
yes,
schooling a young actor in the intricacies of Hamlet. Well, how do you balance caring about these actors and what a script that is a little flippant at times, you know, because
yeah,
the jokes are sort of flippant.
They are. It's, you know, comedy comes in threes, you know, and that's really how it's written. And it was really tough in the first read through. I mean, we were all laughing hysterically, you know, at everybody. And then when we got to like the fourth day of rehearsal, all the stuff that wasn't really grounded in sort of an honest place that these individuals would say wasn't really funny anymore. Because it kept being about the product and not really about what the actor or what the character was needing and who they really are. And so we had to take a step back, and I actually had them do the show one night, like it was a drama. I told them to forget it was funny. And so, and they did, and it was a really nice play. It just wasn't funny. And then we, the next night we had them, you know, I had them put back in the energy that comedic style and that comedic energy. And it was wonderful because they had found this really grounded place, because one of the great things about really good comedy is those people don't know they're funny, you know, and it's that naive, sincere quality, that the characters have that really make us laugh as the audience.
How did the show look different doing it as a drama?
It was really interesting because all of these people, they were very deep and they were very like insightful, and they wanted things and they needed things, and it was intensely, everything was magnified with how great their need was.
I would assume there's still a little bit of humor in it.
There was.
Because, you know, I mean, I'm thinking of one line where the real estate agent and the theatrical agent there's a little banter where, you know, I'm the evilest person in the
yes
world. I'm a real estate agent. And the theatrical agent, nope, you lose. I'm
yes. And the lines that he wrote to be funny were still funny.
Yeah.
And so when we went back to the script and just had the actors, you know, play their stakes and live as these individuals within this text that Paul Rudnick wrote to be funny, it was funny. And it was funny without them trying to be funny and forcing that comedy.
So you move the energy up a little bit, and mm-hmm, you sort of have the little more pauses, but I would assume that sort of carried over.
It did, and it was really nice. It gave us a really great balance, and it didn't feel shticky, you know, for lack of a better word. It didn't feel... One of the things that I, as an audience member, when I go and see a show, a comedy, I don't like to be spoon-fed. You know, I don't like to know when I'm supposed to laugh. I want to laugh when it's funny, when it's honestly funny. And I think
unconscious
really
mugging. If you
I
will
know. Yes.
You know, I mean, it's not, you know, mugging is, you know, you mug for the camera and it's all, you know, it's
right
obvious. But a lot of times it'll be unconscious mugging.
Right. And it's just the actor being aware that they're acting, you know. And when I go to a play, I want to forget that they're acting. I want to get lost into the world of the play. And for me as the director, when I'm directing a comedy, that still applies. Even though it's funny and the audience is going to laugh, I don't want to anticipate when they're going to laugh. And I don't think that you do. I think that we have a really nice balance and we have a lot of heart in this show. And so it's really funny in a honest way.
Well, let me ask you, you opened last week.
Mm-hmm.
How do you fine tune a show between a weekend, since Tulsa is sort of a weekend show town? You have a few days off.
Mm-hmm.
Do you work on things in between? Does it a matter of, okay, we'll come back on Thursday and do it all over again?
Well, I email my actors notes after every performance. So that's, I sit in the back of the house and take notes. And I did that with every show last weekend. And so the notes that I left them on Sunday, we'll see them implemented on Thursday. But for me, it was really important that they have some of that time off, just because it's physically exhausting, the show is, and vocally exhausting. And so I wanted them to be able to take a little bit of a break. And then on Thursday, we'll be back at it. We'll be back at it. So they have had a little bit of a break, but they know what I'm expecting. And after a weekend, they know what to expect kind of from an audience, you know, where the laughs were that were really consistent.
Is that one of the things that it's hard to do? I mean, they always say comedy is hard. Is that one of the things, the fact that you never know how an audience is really going to react until you've had it under your belt a few times?
It is. And it's really difficult for an actor being on stage, you know, and if you have an audience that is just intensely listening to everything that you're doing, and they may find it very funny, but they might not be an audience of loud laughers, you know. And as an actor, it's really, if you're just going for that product and really just wanting to get the laugh, you can get discouraged, and so it affects your performance. And so one of the things that we talk about is that the actors have to stay just conscious of their partner and of the world of the play, and allow the audience to just be the observers, so that the acting stays consistent. And, you know, and then they still hold for the laughs when they get them, and you know, they set the jokes up the way that they're supposed to. And if they don't get the laugh, then they keep moving on. So they're not anticipating it. But it's a fine balance, and the opening weekend is really pivotal for us, because we know what to expect usually with the second weekend. So, and kind of have worked the kinks out a little bit.
Well, we've talked a little about some of the members of the cast. William mm-hmm. Acker plays Andrew Rowley. Tyler Humphreys plays John Barrymore. Tabitha Littlefield plays the girlfriend, Deidre.
Yes.
Tell us about the rest of the cast and sort of a little bit about the characters they play.
Okay. Jenny Guy is the real estate agent.
Right.
Yep.
And very flamboyant.
Very flamboyant.
Out for the commission.
Absolutely. Barbara Mern plays his a theatrical agent, and she's German. And we actually find out that she had a little bit of a tryst with Barrymore back in the day. And so we have, you know, when she enters the apartment, she says, "Oh, I've been here before," you know. And so we get this moment with her where we see her reliving this events that she had with Barrymore in this apartment. And then actually she gets a scene with him later in the show. Barrymore gets to decide who sees him and who doesn't. The guy who plays, Tony Schneider, plays his Andrew's film agent. And the first scene that we see him with, the only person that has seen Barrymore up to that point in the play is Andrew. And then Tony walks in, he plays Gary, and he looks straight at Barrymore and he introduces himself. And Will looks perplexed completely with why this individual can see Barrymore and no one else can. And Barrymore says, "Well, yes, he can see me because it won't make any difference." So, I mean, because it's just, he's there as the agent. He doesn't care if you're talented. He even tells Andrew, "You're no actor." You know, it's just about the product with him. And Tony is wonderful. The energy and the physicality that he brings to that role is really funny.
Now, you're doing this in the Williams Theater, so
yes.
I assume you have the look of Barrymore's apartment.
We do. We have 18-foot walls that are red and the brown paneling, and we have a marble green floor, and we have a second story up to the roof, and it's beautiful. You know, it's very old Hollywood, or old Broadway, I should say, with, you know, we use the act curtain, and it's very grand in scale, just like Barrymore. You know, there's a picture that hangs over the fireplace that's 8 feet long and 5 feet wide of Tyler Humphreys, who plays John Barrymore. So it's very in your face, and it's beautiful. The set is actually really stunning. Jared Roberts is an individual that we brought in from Washington that designed the set for us and did the lighting and everything. So I'm thrilled with how it turned out. And the PAC is just a fantastic venue. We love working in the Williams. So it's a nice marriage for the next week and a half. So,
all right. Well, we wish you great success with I Hate Hamlet by Paul Rudnick. Performances continue tonight through Saturday at the Williams Theater of the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. Courtney, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Courtney Sanders is the artistic director for Playhouse Tulsa and director of their first production of the season, I Hate Hamlet, by Paul Rudnick. Performances continue tonight through Saturday at the Williams Theater of the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. Curtain time is 7:30. For ticket information, visit myticketoffice.com or call 918-596-7111. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Our commentator Barry Friedman has a remembrance of the late great musician J.J. Cale.
I didn't go to talk about Cale. It was 2005, and I was at Boston's doing a story on Tom Skinner's science project. Skinner was sitting on the edge of the stage between sets replacing a guitar string. Larry Spears, a songwriter, Bradley James, a guitarist, Jimmy Karstein, a drummer, and I were at a table, and a flutist walked by. Really, he was wearing a silk shirt unbuttoned halfway. "What do you think happens to you in life?" Spears asked. "Make you want to play the flute." But the guy could play, so he could stay. That's how it worked. And then someone mentioned After Midnight. J.J. Cale was coming to Keynes. Karstein, who had been Cale's drummer and in the band on and off for 40 years, would be playing. I asked if he could tell me about After Midnight, about Clapton, about Cale. Jimmy just waved me off, looked towards the stage. Ah, hell, go ask some of them. They'll kill you to death. When Cale died, I called Jimmy, who was at Cale's funeral, wrote Tom Skinner, who felt more than he knew, called Brad James, who had lost a muse. Spear said, there's a clean line from Cale to where we are now. Here's what they told me. Brad James, guitarist. Hell, I'll kill you to death. JJ was a made-up stage name. The people that I knew that were his family called him John. It seemed like his musician buddies called him Cale, and it was a dead giveaway when people would call him JJ that they were fans. Jimmy Karstein, drummer. That story's true. Elmer Valentine, who was co-founder of the Whiskey A Go-Go in L.A., where Cale was playing one night, he took him out and saw the sign and said, John, look at that. Look at that sign. I got Johnny Rivers. I got Johnny Cale. I got too many Johnnies. I need you to change your name to JJ, okay? Now, I heard that story from the horse's mouth, but Cale was also the kind of guy who would tell you the Arkansas River was filled with Pepsi-Cola and expect you to believe it, so who knows? Tom Skinner, singer-songwriter. Oakey Flag should fly at half-mast until further notice. Karstein. He was just a guy like the rest of us. He absolutely shunned fan adulation, the stardom. He thought of himself as a songwriter and a guitar player more than he did JJ. James. If we try to analyze why the recordings are so rich, did he double the vocal or use a drum machine and then add a real shaker? Is he really just talking out loud to the band during the take? Then it seems all very mysterious. Before the internet, it was hard to even know what he looked like. The albums didn't have much in the way of pictures. But first time the needle dropped on the vinyl, I knew. Karstein. He wore out the soles of his tennis shoes going from the house to the mailbox to pick up residual checks. One time we were sitting around his house talking about fame, notoriety, and he put his palm face down, parallel to the floor, a couple feet high, like he'd measure a little kid, and said, I like it right here. Skinner. I wasn't as close as Brad, but he was for sure a musical hero to me. James. I think one of the really captivating things about the recorded music is the groove. I used to think that Cale must know all the right guys to come lay it down on the records. Really, though, one-on-one, just one guy, one guitar. He was the groove. That was the Tulsa sound. The groove. Skinner. I was really nervous, and he was extremely warm and gracious and down-to-earth. He encouraged me to keep doing what I was doing so I could unite the local music scene. James. One-of-a-kind rhythm guitar. He is revered among guitarists for his amazing lead playing, but he was the best at solo rhythm guitar. I am really sick of the idea of never being able to hang out or hear him again. I'm really sad for Christine Lakeland, his wife, and Karstein, who loved him for their whole lives, just for a good guy, that he was a good guy, and not a J.J. Cale. Sad for their loss. I'm sure, though, that after all the lean years, that he appreciated the mailbox money. Karstein. The other night at the memorial service at McCabe's Bar and Grill in Santa Monica, and Clapton was there, Clapton said, Cale was the older brother I never had. Now, I never got that sense, because we were friends, but... James, what I'll remember? That we got to play some music together in this life. That my dad realized how cool it was that John Cale knew my name.
Barry Friedman is a writer, essayist, and columnist for Tulsa People magazine and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening. I keep blowing and blowing. I ain't got me nobody. I ain't getting me no love. Ain't no change.